Matt, your claim that the Koreans have some claim over China through the Manchurians is doubtful.
Is that how he talks?
No, I have no idea how Nuclear Bob talks.
Welcome to East Meets West, episode 119. I'm Tom Merritt.
And I'm cold. It's very cold in here.
Yes, you're Roger Chang.
I am Roger
you're
Chang.
You're a cold Roger Chang.
I'm a cold SOB.
You were just mentioning that post. I read an interesting Scientific American article about gene expression yesterday.
So how is Gene?
He's doing okay. He sometimes expresses differently.
Oh.
Depending on
gossip.
What parts of the gene are activated.
They
were saying that, like, it's not mutations in the actual genes, but the way they're expressed that changes whether you're a zebra or a marmot.
So, in other words, all mammalian or just all life forms carry the same genes?
Well, they're not all carry the same genes, but in other words, when you look at mammals, almost all of them have 90% similar genes.
Yes.
Because those genes are coding for things that are expressed differently depending on what proteins actually get activated and what don't. And it's the activation of the expression of the gene in different parts of the DNA that determine whether that same DNA coding sequence actually activates a protein or not. And that's what causes you to, like, one example they used was there's a fish that in certain lakes has lost one of its tail fins because there were parasites that would latch onto it and eat it.
Uh-huh.
But it keeps the fin if you find that same species in the open water because that fin helps it to evade predators in the open sea.
Hmm. So now, is this based entirely on environmental circumstances?
That particular one is, but in other words, the evolutionary pressures aren't necessarily pressures on mutations in the genes themselves, but whether they get expressed or not. And the biggest example they used was fruit flies and the expression of the yellow gene,
Drosophila,
which determines whether there is a black spot or not, either on the wing or the abdomen.
So, in other words, all those inherited characteristics are present, but whether or not they're expressed.
And when they're expressed. Like, they may be expressed in the development of a certain organ, but not expressed in the development of another organ.
Interesting. So does this mean I can make a chimp out of a grain of rice?
You can try.
Hmm. Interesting.
I'm not sure how you'd go about that. I mean, a grain of rice and a chimp are going to have a lot different basic genetic material than, say, a chimp and a human.
That is true.
And there was one, and I wish I had the article right in front of me now, but there was one gene they were talking about in particular that was the same in chimps and humans, but the expression in the humans was much different, and it had to do with our ability to think. But
Brain size, something to do with walking upright?
Well, no, it wasn't brain size or walking upright. No, it was just like a perceptual ability. Like, it was very much more specific. I wish I had the article in front of me. I'd be able to tell you.
Interesting. I'd like to look at that at some point.
Look it up, sciem.com.
Oh, is it available? I'm not sure how they do things on
I think you have to
site.
Pay, actually, to get those articles online.
One thing
remember.
I like about The Economist is a lot of
when you pay for the magazine, you get the articles online for free. Is that right? Is that what you're going to say?
Oh, no. It's that they offer up a lot of their content for free online.
Yeah. And if you are a subscriber to the magazine, you get the paid website content as part of your subscription.
Well, and that's the thing is a lot of the stuff they cover online on The Economist is actually in the actual print version.
They do that podcast too, which I like, where they kind of read a couple of the main stories out of the magazine and say for more, buy the magazine.
And I hate to be too web centric about this, but one thing I like that The Economist has done is opened up the comments, like they allow you to comment on stories that they didn't allow before.
Yeah.
So it's interesting because you get a lot of feedback, like all things that have people have the
open comments.
Open comments, you get a lot of crap, right? I mean, you get people saying that you get into arguments with different posters.
Flame wars.
Yeah, but at the same time, it's also good because you get a very honest, or I hope honest, kind of viewpoint on the subject matter that they're talking about.
Did you hear the Economist rap?
What? They have a rap song?
It was put out on the Guardian website. I think I may have found it through Boing Boing or something. But they kind of rap about, it's called a eulogy Here it is. Actually,
So if you type economist eulogy?
If you type Guardian economist rap, it's the top search result in Google. And it goes a little something like this, I think. Although it's not playing. Oh, there we go. They use some of the music from the economist podcast, too. A tiny country makes the best of a bad. This is by Psychotic, rap duo, PSIKOTIC. This is just the prelude. A little long.
Are we going to run into copyright issues?
Probably. Yeah. It'll be good press for East Meets
Best. Had a couple issues, thought, how pleasing. The price is high, but to subscribe was so teasing. He filled out the form, said, bill me later. Now it's MVP, most valuable paper. Of The Economist, he is now an avid reader. Hopes to grow up to be a world leader. The magazine that tells the world how it should be. Cream of the crop since 1843. Booze reasonable, like sensible shoes. Not in a bad way, take long-range views. In
a That's a copyright violation right there.
Used. What, using The Economist
No, that music. No, that music.
That's
that,
The Economist podcast. Music.
That music is actually from the Penguin Orchestra.
Oh, The Economist uses that as the theme song for their podcast.
It's from a piece called Perpetual Motion. They use it a lot in commercials. It's a copyright. I have the CD.
But is it not fair use because they just took a clip and looped it?
I know, but that's what I'm saying. Like, you know, well, that's my question. If you do take something, say like if Mariah Carey sang for a commercial, say like for Time Magazine, and you use that same clip, would that still be fair use at that point?
Yeah, I mean, it's tricky. It's up to the court to decide.
I don't know why I chose Mariah Carey either.
There's not a definite like length of time or anything. I think it's a 4-part test, if I remember correctly, from what like Colette Vogel was telling on The Real Deal and CNET Live when she was on. But it's kind of up to interpretation, in other words.
So was this a teenage girl that created this? Because it says Ike Egerton, which doesn't sound like a girl, but Chris Misa could be.
No. Why do you assume it would be a teenage girl at all?
Because the Economist bid to appeal more youthful to the reader seems to be paying off after two 17-year-olds created a rap about the business title while Facebook...
Two 17-year-olds. Okay. I see.
Yeah, I'm just bringing the Guardian story.
Oh, where's the story? I only have the actual file.
Oh, jeez. It's the one that says Economist wraps up youth market. From Mark Sweeney?
No, all I have, I searched Guardian Economist rap and got audio, Psychotics, The Economist rap.
What did you search? Economist Guardian rap. I searched with IE, so I think it went through live instead of Google.
Economist wins acclaim from rap duo and Facebook fan group?
Yeah, so I'm not, yeah, right there.
Okay, yeah, now I'm looking at that. Rap created by U.S. students like Egerton and Chris Misa under the name Psychotic as a tribute that includes... Yeah, okay. I don't know if it's a tribute as much as a send-up.
Yeah.
It does seem a little bit poking fun at The Economist at the same time.
You know, in some ways, the thing is, honestly, I feel in many ways The Economist doesn't feel like the same magazine it was maybe like 10, 12 years ago, that recent. And I'm not sure if it has to do with their
the thickness of the paper.
Not even that, just kind of the...
That's what you told me one time.
No, I said one of the things I noticed was the magazine was thinner than like, you know, 10 years ago when I was reading in college.
You're like, they're on cheap-ass paper now.
No, they were
obviously
always
the journalism isn't as good.
They own... Oh. No, the thing is, I'm not sure if they had a big overturn in writers because the writing style is a little different. And they tend to be a lot more opinionated in the stories than they used to be. Before, they used to be really like... They've always painstakingly been very they wanted to appear even handed, but now they've
always had a point of view, but I know what you mean, yeah. Where they tend to be a little preachy, which they never were.
Which is exactly, and I got, you know, with the editorials with Baghot and Lexington, you kind of expect that.
Because it's commentary, right.
But to have it in the story, and I've noticed a lot in news stories, even from the AP and Reuters, is there just seems to be... You know, almost kind of a sewn in or written in editorial along with the story, which I didn't notice. And I'm not sure if it's because they're fighting for subscribers, so they want to appear more bloggy or more.
Well, yeah, I mean that's what everybody assumes, right? Is that they're fighting the blogs, which are not journalistic in a lot of cases. They're avowedly opinion. They're avowedly saying, like, this is my opinion about what I'm talking about. But there's also, Hunter S. Thompson used to rail against objectivity in journalism because he's like, look, you can't be objective.
That's true.
And trying to be objective is not a problem, but pretending as if you have achieved objectivity is. Was sort of his stance, which is like, be honest about what your point of view is, and then strain to be fair.
Yeah.
But don't try to pretend like you're some third person godlike voice that
you
is
mean some
that
cosmic
has no opinion at all.
Some cosmic overseer that just kind of looks and watches.
I may have mentioned this before on the show, even, but I put that question when I was in my internship at NPR. We would have these weekly meetings as part of the internship with like journalists and high ranking people in Washington and everything, and I put that question to both Gwen Ifill, who was then a Washington correspondent for the New York Times and a host of one of the NPR programs, one of the hosts of All Things Considered. And Gwen Ifill, I thought, answered very well and said, you know, when I walk into a courtroom, the first thing I notice is how many black women there are. And that's just because that's who I am. I'm a black woman, and I'm not going to get over that. So, I need to be aware of that. And in my reporting, kind of calculate that in. She's like, that doesn't mean I don't try to be fair. But yes, everybody is going to come from a certain point of view. And I thought that was a really good answer. However, the All Things Considered host said to me, if you don't think you can be objective, you need to get out of this business right now.
Well,
which I thought was very close-minded.
You know, and that's the thing is, like, I have nothing with having a point of view in the story. However, you do have a point of view, and like you said, you pretend to be objective as you write. It's very obvious.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And it comes off as almost patronizing and in some really cases almost kind of conniving, like you're just trying to get one, you know, past the reader. And this is what's always bothered me about European papers, you know, is that, I mean, European being, you know, like non-British or English language, especially from like Germany and French, French newspapers, German and French newspapers, is that they're quite unabashedly fine with writing in an editorial into the story. So if it's a story about, say, a paper mill, you know, it won't say like, you know, the workers are in a process of negotiations with the employer. It's like, you know, the browbeaten workers who have, you know, struggled and, you know, they emphasize certain aspects to cast.
Well, that's actually more in the tradition of the press. It's only in the 20th century that there was starting to be a movement towards objectivity. It used to be that you'd pick your paper based on your point of view.
No, I totally
you'd buy
understand.
The Democratic paper or the Labor paper or the Communist paper and expect to get that. And I think that's just, they never got out of that tradition, I guess.
No, it's really interesting because, you know, I try to read as much from as many viewpoints as possible, and you know, it's interesting to see the same take on the different takes on the same story. Like, you know, you'll have one where, for example, if it involves migrant workers, you have one from say like it's a farm worker here in California, you'll have one from a Latin American paper with their, you know, their viewpoint of the worker. And then you'll have one here about the entirety of the business, you know, versus, you know, the immigrant worker. Then you'll have maybe a local paper with the local communities, you know, kind of a viewpoint, which is, you know, I think it's good to get a pretty good chunk of information across the board, which is interesting because of recent developments in South Africa. Have you been keeping up with
which developments are?
That's
you speaking
the one
of?
Where a lot of the immigrant workers and legal aliens have been like attacked and set on fire, and a lot of others. It's interesting. It's like it's very well covered in certain papers, like in the UK, Australia, but out like in and maybe in certain Canadian outlets, but like here, it's like it's buried. As most things are.
Well, I was going to say that's nothing unusual.
But it's also buried in a couple of other what I usually consider pretty international papers. I mean, even rags like the Spiegel, Der Spiegel, are pretty up on things like that. At least in their international section, didn't have anything, which is quite interesting. But I mean, considering how violent and how much coverage that Zimbabwe got, you know, about Mugabe. That a lot of this stuff has managed to kind of slip away into the margins, so to speak.
So by this time, this week and in a few days, we will most likely have a Democratic nominee for the presidential race.
Yep.
Because June 1st, June 3rd of the last three primaries. I can't remember which is which. Puerto Rico is on one day and North Dakota and Montana are on the other 2 days. And then it's up to the superdelegates, essentially, because there's not enough delegates out there for one.
I've always found
Barack Obama to gain the win. There certainly aren't enough delegates for Hillary Clinton to gain the win. They both would require the superdelegates. And the way it's been looking, the superdelegates are all declaring for Obama now. So at this point, it's just Hillary says she won't quit until the primaries are done. Unless she can convince somebody to redo the Florida and Michigan primaries, he wins.
It'll be interesting to see. I find it interesting that a lot of the U.S. territories that, like Puerto Rico and Guam, and have been, you know, so heavily treaded since I don't think they get an option to vote in the.
They get to vote. They get no electoral votes.
Ah.
So Puerto Rico goes to the polls and they get to vote for president, and their vote counts in the popular vote. But because they get no electoral representation, their vote does not count in the Electoral College.
Got it.
Regarding the Libertarian presidential nomination, Bob Barr apparently got the nomination. That was the story that I read yesterday. Bob Barr is a former Republican, part-time Republican, I guess. So he beat out Dr. Mary Ruart. There was like a several ballot process where slowly different candidates would drop out and ask their supporters to cast their ballot. It was sort of a caucus type thing, except at the party convention.
He was considered this Wikipedia bio. He has, quote, he was described as, quote, the idol of gun-toting, abortion-fighting, RS-hating, hard right-wing of American politics, end quote.
He's against the Iraq War.
However, Barr's criticism of the Bush administration's encroachment on privacy and other civil liberties after 9/11 was unusual among House Republicans. This criticism earned Barr other labels such as Maverick, Jekyll and Hyde, and Libertarian.
He's actually quite popular with a segment of the Republican Party, and folks are actually having a little bit of a Ralph Nader worry about Bob Barr for Republicans, the way people are worried that Nader would steal votes from the Democratic
I can actually see it with McCain, because McCain has been so divisive in that,
and he's a moderate. And it sounds like Barr has less moderate opinions.
I mean, whenever you try to reach the middle, you're always going to start burning your particular group's, you know, outer fringes. So, and more conservative leaning, more of the kind of the Bush style Republican would probably.
Well, Bush is weird. President Bush is a weird guy because he's a weird guy. His presidency has been odd because he campaigned as a moderate and was elected in 2000. Well, is elected by the Electoral College in 2000 as a moderate.
Yeah.
And he seems to have,
which is why I never really believe what any of the candidates say.
He has swung around in many ways to be a very staunch conservative, but kept his moderate views in a few places like immigration.
Well, and that's the thing is, remember how we used to discuss that the whole label of moderate liberal was kind of, or moderate liberal conservative was kind of misleading?
Yeah.
Because you can have very, I know people who are very quote unquote conservative, but they're pretty liberal on a few things like immigration.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, these are people who are business people, so they tend to have, you know, their outlooks tend to be a little different on certain aspects. They're not big religious people, but they do believe in fiscal accountability. They believe in the elimination of race-based preferences for education, stuff like that. So, you know, for some people, yeah, that means you're, you know, straight up, you know, conservative, or does that mean you're liberal with, you know, or liberal on one hand for fiscal things and conservative leaning on other things? I don't know. It's all kind of weird. Like one example I used to give is like, you know, you can't have a, you know, ostensibly, you know, a socialist style outlook, but still be kind of, you know, super right wing. You know, sort of.
One of the things that was a big eye-opening for me when I was in college, as I got to know people in Well, there were a couple of different libertarian organizations. There was a libertarian organization that was much along the lines of classic libertarian, which is small government.
Yep.
And civil liberties. And then there was the more right-wing Buchanan libertarians at the time who were very much for gun rights and
isolationists.
And pretty much just right-wing conservative, but they called themselves libertarian. And then there was the International Socialists and the Communists yep. and the other left-wing. And it was amazing to see where they would start to merge. The right wing, and especially the right wing libertarians, not the classic libertarians, and the communists and the international socialists would start to say the same thing.
Oh yeah, no, totally. And and it's so funny because I had this huge debate on, and it was a part of a larger topic of religion and politics, and how I always saw them as kind of exactly as the same thing, and people were arguing against it. So it's like how is we were talking about different parties. How's like Bob, blah, 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 super conservative, who has like a cross hanging up in his living room, any different than, say, you, who has like a picture framed of Che Guevara sitting in your living room? You both quote, passages out of someone else's writings and claim it as your moral or kind of imperative because based on that to do what you do, right? I mean, it's to me, it's six in one hand, half a dozen in the other. It stays two different sides of the same coin.
While we're talking about elections, listener number one, Jason Adkins, posted on the subbrilliant.com/EMW blog. He says, back to election reform. My plan to get rid of the Electoral College and the drawn-out primary season. Separate party primaries in June. No more caucuses, and all the states have to either have an open primary or none at all. No mixed systems. If a party primary doesn't have one candidate getting 50% plus one of the vote, party runoffs in July. General election as it is in November, if no candidate gets a national majority, runoff 2 to 3 weeks later. One other thing I find interesting, that the Libertarian Party wants government to butt out, but wants to have a spot on the ballot. I haven't seen anything in the Constitution that mentions political parties.
Well, it's my thing. It's like, why couldn't we have a system where you'd have everyone that wants to be president just be in the freaking election?
Well, I am with Jason on the general election, which is, why do parties get a guaranteed spot on the ballot? I understand why the Libertarian Party wants one since the Democrats and Republicans have one, but it is sort of counterintuitive. It's like, shouldn't they really be lobbying to say nobody should get a guaranteed spot?
Yeah, well, it's like, why don't you just, have everyone... have like Obama, Hillary, and everyone else in the Democrat, or that was...
That's chaos, Roger.
Oh, it's so... It's just like...
And my only problem with Jason's primary ideas are actually fairly reasonable. My only problem with that is like the parties aren't part of the government.
No.
And so therefore they should be allowed to nominate whoever they want to the ballot. If they can get enough signatures to get them on the ballot, fine. I don't care how they pick them. They want to have a caucus. They want to have a drawing.
I think they should
They want to roll dice. They want to play D&D. I don't care. What I don't like is this idea that the Democrats and the Republicans are now institutions within the government. And that the primary system should somehow be run by the government. Because I think that further just enshrines a two-party system. I have no problem with a natural two-party system if that's all we want is two parties. But I think it should be wide open.
Yeah, I totally agree. It's just... the more validation you give to that these particular parties are...
I would even go so far as to say ossification.
Ossification? Fossilization?
I'm sorry, ossifer. I didn't know how fast I was going.
And it's kind of weird. I guess when something goes long as it has... I mean, how long has the Republican Party been around? Since the 18...
Lincoln was the first Republican, was he not?
Yeah. I think so. Yeah.
I believe that is... I don't know if he was the first Republican, but he was the first Republican president, and I think the party dates to that era. That's a good question, though. I know that Lincoln is often... It's one of those things where Lincoln is often described as the first Republican, and he was definitely the first Republican president, but I don't know if the party had roots, when you really want to be real about it, whether the party had roots before that. Which Republican? We're talking about the Republican Party of the United States, correct?
Yes, 1854.
Okay. Founded by the anti-slavery expansion activists and modernizers, rose to prominence with the election of Abraham Lincoln.
Yeah.
So rose to prominence with. It didn't start necessarily exactly with
him. He gave it the positive spin.
He made it real. And then the Democrats go back to the Democratic Republicans, which was a party essentially started by Thomas Jefferson and others as the first party.
Yep.
And they were the anti-federalists, were they not? And then there was a Federalist Party. Yep. They sort of failed to try to form an opposition to the Democratic Republicans.
And didn't they come out of what was their original? Didn't they come out of something of the Progressives, the Progressive Party, Republican?
Well, the party presided over the American Civil War and Reconstruction was harried by internal factions and scandals toward the end of the 19th century. But it does not say anything about progressivism in this Wikipedia article. So you got me there.
Mm.
That we'd have to do more research on.
List of political parties. Too long.
Yes. Shall we move on to the next topic?
Move.
Dinesh wanted to clarify his post about the Aryan invasion, which proposes a recent situation of Aryans invading India and conquering the already existing people there, who were then pushed to the south, and then single-handedly the Aryans set up a civilization as we know it. I'm sure you can see why Hitler enjoyed that idea. It was also part of the British divide-and-conquer rule of India by dividing India into Aryan and non-Aryan peoples, and that's what has been disproven through genetic research, which has basically shown that the entire Indian subcontinent is far more genetically similar and that the effects of any new migrations after the initial out-of-Africa migrations were minor. He points to an article by Michael Danino, which details it further. It isn't really of much importance in the general sense, but it has led to a history of the debate and divisiveness of India, and obviously to the Nazis' racial theory. So I'm glad you clarified that, because that makes a lot of sense. In other words, there was this idea, and I've actually read this idea separate. I read it in Mein Kampf, but I also read it separately in an old history book that kind of took it as fact that the Aryan peoples moved in and conquered most of the subcontinent of India, and they were of a lighter skin and all of this crazy stuff.
It's funny because...
And that's what's been disproven, and that's what Dinesh was talking about.
The way I understood it originally was it was just a group that was a migrating group that just settled in the northern part of India. And, you know, they did not...
And then just intermingled. I think that may be more the truth of
it. They did not set up shop and create the great Aryan warehouse.
But there was a theory that they had subjugated the dark peoples of the continent.
Put it this way: back when anthropology was getting its big kick, when they were searching for the ancestors of modern humans, where did they go digging? That's right, in their backyards.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, obviously of the Franco race, right, or the, the British race, and it's so funny because the things like Piltdown Man, which essentially was a human skull with an orangutan jaw. Everyone was trying to prove that their bit of soil was where mankind sprouted forth, or modern man.
Now, there's still some controversy of whether everyone came out of Africa, or if there was a double migration from Java and Africa. There's some people that want to push
because they found fossils older than what has been recorded. So it's interesting. I mean, generally, the general consensus is that there was this population 2,000-3,000 individuals that came out of Africa and through the north and the Mesopotamian region.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if those Java finds will give ammunition for those who want to say that there were others as well, or it could be it might have been a different group of hominids.
Mm-hmm.
Like the Neanderthals,
a similar hominid but slightly different, or convergent evolution of some
sort. I haven't
been
in anthropology in 12 years?
You've been in anthropology?
No, in studying anthropology.
Oh, I see. All right, that'll do it for us today. Thanks for listening, folks.
Yeah, and hopefully, we'll talk to you next week.
Subbrilliant.com/EMW if you'd like to talk back or have a conversation amongst yourselves, as happened this past week about the whole China and Tibet. That was a great conversation on there.
If
you want to know more about it, check it out, subbrilliant.com/EMW.
Bye.
Bye.